Alors, je vais laisser la parole dans quelques minutes à mon collègue Mathias Meyer. Mathias Meyer est un chercheur qui travaille à l'Institut Max Planck de Leipzig, donc le même institut que celui où je sévis depuis quelques années. Et Mathias a joué un rôle très très important dans tous ces travaux de paléogénétique qu'on évoque régulièrement quand l'on parle des Néandertaliens, des Denisoviens et des premiers hommes modernes. Et notamment, il a mis au point des techniques qui ont permis le séquençage avec une très très grande résolution du génome de ces formes fossiles. Et si vous allez sur Internet, vous trouverez mention de ces travaux abondamment.
Thank you very much to Jean-Jacques for inviting me here to give a talk at this prestigious institution. It's a big honor for me. Unfortunately, I cannot speak in French to you. I wish I could stay here longer and learn the language, but who knows, maybe. Maybe I can come to France for longer at some point in my life. So for now, I have to stick to English. I would like to give you a sort of some summary of what we've learned about human evolution in the last decade or so by studying the DNA of fossils. And some of this overlaps with what Jean-Jacques has already presented, but I think I'll try to give you a little bit more of a technical perspective on how these DNA sequences are generated, how the data is actually analyzed, so that hopefully by the end of this talk it seems a bit less esoteric to you, sort of the inferences made from ancient genomes. The main characters of this talk are the Neanderthals that are sort of known by everyone, of course, the Denisovans that have been mentioned just before, as well as a particular group of people from a cave in Spain, from Cima de los Huesos. But to sort of start on a very basic level, just to remind you what we're actually looking at, this is the structure of DNA. It's this beautiful helical structure that can be duplicated to form a double helix, and that provides a perfect mechanism to copy the genetic material in the cell. And the DNA in the cell is there are two types of DNA in the cell. The first is, and this is sort of the most important part of the DNA, is the nuclear genome, which sits in the nucleus inside the cell, and contains roughly 3 billion base pairs of sequence. And this encodes for basically all our phenotypic features. There's also this little molecule here, it's a mitochondrial genome, which sits in an organelle, the mitochondria, which are responsible for energy metabolism in the cell. And both types of DNA can be very useful to make inferences about relatedness and evolutionary inferences in general. Now, what's important to understand about DNA is that it is a very stable molecule. As it carries the genetic information, we have to make sure, or nature has to make sure, that it remains stable from generation to generation. Nonetheless, in every cell, in every living cell, there are thousands of damage events per hour, about 2,000 to 3,000. And the organism is constantly repairing these damages to make sure that the DNA remains intact. Nonetheless, some of these damages are actually not repaired. And if these damages occur in sperms or in egg cells, they are passed on to the next generation. So if I compare my DNA to the DNA of one of my kids, I would actually find about 50 to 100 differences. And then you can ask, so where do these differences occur? Well, they occur mostly randomly across the genome. And in only rare cases, they will actually hit what is sort of usually considered a gene, a protein coding region of the genome that actually is translated into functional units. And so most of these mutations occur in the yellow and the green parts here, which have either regulatory function or they have sort of no known function to date. So as a result of this, most mutations actually do not affect the fitness of an individual. And this has led to the neutral theory of molecular evolution, that you have mutations arising and they are not subject to natural selection. They accumulate and they sort of make no difference to the organism. And because of this, sort of, we start to develop differences between people. And so if you compare two human beings, which I think we can agree that both of them are humans, then you would find about 3 million differences. If you compare any one human to a chimpanzee, you would find about 30 million differences. And as most of these differences are neutral and do not affect the phenotype, they basically give us sort of independent characters that we can use to reconstruct relatedness between people. And if we do this just based on modern DNA that has been done already in early studies in the 80s, then you see a very peculiar picture. So this is a phylogenetic tree relating the sequences of a worldwide set of modern humans. It includes their mitochondrial DNA sequence, but you could take any part of the genome, you would get the same tree. And it shows that if you are from Africa, so if you compare two humans from Africa, so you have to walk further down in the tree, sort of, and then back up again, sort of to meet your relative. Meaning that the deepest divergences in these tree you have all in Africa. Whereas if you go outside of Africa, the tree is much more shallow. So suggesting that at some point a group of people has left Africa and only took with them a limited number of genetic, limited genetic variation, so that people outside of Africa today are much more closely related to each other than people in Africa or than people outside of Africa to Africans. And this has been very strong evidence for the out of Africa idea of modern human evolution. Now it would be great, of course, not to only look at present day human DNA, but also look into ancient DNA, and we sort of know that this is possible, of course. But just to give you a little bit of a biochemical background of why we're actually able to do this. Ancient DNA can be extracted from heart tissue, and this is usually bones and teeth. There are some exotic tissues like dental calculus, for example, that are also being explored, but the majority of data comes from bones and teeth. And bones and teeth are composed of a protein component, collagen, which makes the bone elastic, and they are composed of a mineral component, hydroxyapatite, which gives the rigidity to the bone, so to make it compact and solid. And this hydroxyapatite, which sort of comes in nice crystals, it's basically a calcium phosphate compound, has a very interesting feature. And just to show you an experiment here, like real experiment from one of my students, we've taken a mixture of DNA fragments of different sizes dissolved it in water and then added a little bit of hydroxyapatite powder. And what happens is all this DNA disappears. It instantly binds to the hydroxyapatite. And then you can do multiple treatments here. You can wash it in water. You can wash it in sort of mild buffers in salt-containing solutions. And the DNA sticks tightly to the bone. And it really requires very harsh chemical treatment to then get the DNA back from the hydroxyapatite. You basically have to dissolve the hydroxyapatite to get it back. And this experiment you can repeat with ancient bones. So you can take bones that are anywhere in age between 40 and 100,000 years, for example, expose them to DNA, and the DNA will disappear and only reappear if you do a harsh chemical treatment on the bone. So demonstrating that hydroxyapatite, which is present also in ancient bones, does have a very strong binding capacity for DNA. And this goes, this is basically unlimited, so you can take a bone, a very old bone, 600,000 years, and you will see the same effect, and you can even go down to a dinosaur bone, and you can still bind DNA very efficiently to a dinosaur bone. So this is a great gift to us from nature, that the DNA preserves so nicely in an hydroxyapatite, which is one of the major components of bones and teeth. Now the problem is, of course, even though heart tissues do have a binding capacity for ancient for DNA, DNA still is subject to decay over time. And there are a number of chemical reactions taking place, one of the most prominent ones being the loss of bases, process called depurination, because as purine bases, letters A and G are most easily lost. And once these bases are lost, you induce strand breaks and your DNA becomes fragmented. And you can model this actually. You can sort of in a computer simulate the distribution of DNA fragment sizes that you would get at a certain damage frequency. And then you will see that there are hardly any long fragments left, even at a relatively low damage rate, and most of your DNA is very short. And then if you go to more and more damaged, to higher and higher frequencies of damage, which accumulates over time, your DNA becomes shorter and shorter and shorter. So this is one of the main characteristics of ancient DNA that makes it very complicated to work with. And then eventually, of course, if the DNA becomes too short, it will just disappear, and then there's no more genetic information that can be retrieved. These processes are highly temperature dependent, and so for that reason, if you go into cool climates, into the permafrost conditions, then you has been shown that you're able to retrieve DNA from fossils that are almost a million years old. Now the problem is, since we are mostly interested in human evolution here, there are no human fossils in permafrost, at least no archaic human fossils known from permafrost, and so we are limited to non-permafrost conditions. And non-permafrost conditions are much more difficult because in the last 100,000 years, late Pleistocene has been mostly cooler than now. But if you go further back in time, you have these temperature fluctuations, interglacials, with extended warm periods. And of course, in these periods, it's very difficult for DNA to survive through these times. And so for that reason, in almost all of the work that was done in the last, since that field was created, in almost all of the convincing work, analyses were limited to the last 100, 120,000 years. And there's almost no evidence, but I will come to this later, for DNA outside of permafrost surviving longer than this. Now still, even being limited mostly to 100,000 years, there are many interesting things that you can ask, because there are important events in human evolution that took place in this time period. And one of them obviously being the expansion of humans out of Africa and the colonization of the world by modern humans. So the first insight from ancient DNA was actually made based on mitochondrial DNA. And for a simple reason, because mitochondrial DNA is present in many, many more copies per cell. You only have two copies of a nuclear genome from your father and your mother, but you have thousands of copies from the mitochondrial genome, so it's easier to retrieve. And the first time that was actually successfully done was in 1997, a short 200 letters of sequence from a Neanderthal, and not just from a Neanderthal, but from the Neanderthal type specimen, Feldhofer 1 from Germany. And the sequence then, of course, could be put into the context of a tree with modern humans. This is just, again, to remind you here that we have the lower genetic diversity outside of Africa. We do have deeper branches within Africa. And now if you put the Neanderthal sequence in, you see that it falls outside of the known variation in modern humans. And this has actually been replicated in later studies using different Neanderthal specimens. It has been shown that all the Neanderthal sequences fall together in the tree, sort of to the exclusion of human sequences. And it has been concluded back in 97, based on these data, that Neanderthals cannot have been our direct ancestors. Because had they been our direct ancestors, their mitochondrial DNA should be somewhere within the human diversity and not outside. Now, the problem is that DNA is just one part of the genome, and I'll come to this later. It just gives you one aspect of relatedness between individuals, and it would be much better to sequence the nuclear genome, or at least parts of the nuclear genome. And for a long time, this has been sort of a science fiction idea. So no one would have believed that this would ever be possible before like very powerful machines were developed, powerful DNA sequencers. And this is sort of one of the current models that are available on the market. And using such a machine, you can generate something like 3 billion DNA sequences in a single run within a few days on this machine. And that compares to, Until 2005, only 96 sequences you could do at the same time. So there's been this enormous revolution in genetics, in like by many, many orders of magnitude more data that you can produce these days. At some point, this will affect all of us. I think we are not too far away from times where you go to a doctor and the doctor will actually prescribe, give you a prescription for genome sequencing because it's become so so cheap. Sort of until the 2000s, early 2000s, it was it took billions to sequence the first billions of US dollars to sequence the first human genome. Now we are on the order of hundreds of thousands of euros to sequence a complete human genome. And sort of how do these technologies work? So it's actually, it's not too complicated a process. First is you have to extract the DNA from your fossil and purify it from sort of salts and proteins and contamination that's present in the bone. And then you have to convert your DNA into a format that's readable by one of these high-tech sequencers. And this is just achieved by adding two artificial pieces of DNA to each end. So the same sort of artificial DNA sequences are joined to each DNA fragment. And then these sequences can be used to make thousands or millions of copies from each of these molecules, basically immortalizing the information. So you can copy up all the DNA fragments you've isolated from a bone, and then for the next sort of centuries or millennia even, you could in principle keep sequencing this DNA or do more experiments with it. And then afterwards they are put into the DNA sequencer, and then they are read out starting from these linker or adapter sequences through the molecule. You generate the sequence of the complete DNA fragment. Once you have these sequences, you make use of the fact that we have a high quality human genome available for comparison. And we do something that's called a mapping assembly, which is you use the genome as a map, the existing human genome as a map, and you take all your DNA sequences, slide them along the genome, and see if they fit somewhere. And then you take the next fragment, do the same thing. And then you slowly start to hit the genome in different parts and build up what we call coverage. And so the first time this has been successfully done on a larger scale on Neanderthal sample was in 2010. Three Neanderthal bones from Vindhya Cave. So this genome was not from a single Neanderthal individual, but from three. And this genome was sequenced to 1.3-fold coverage. And coverage in this case just means that on average, each position in the genome is seen 1.3 times. This in reality means that most of the positions are seen one times, as here. There are some positions where you have no information, and there are also some positions where you have two informative sequences. So it's relatively low quality. It's not a complete genome, but it gives you a first sort of very good overview of the Neanderthal genome. And then some very fundamental questions could be asked with this data. And the first being a very simple question is, how different are Neanderthals from us? And I think it can be useful to sort of give numbers for this. So again, putting this into a context of modern humans. So if you compare the nuclear genomes of two people outside of Africa, you will on average find 0.8 differences per thousand. So you have to go more than 1,000 letters in the sequences to find the difference. If you compare any a European or Asian to an African, or two Africans to each other, you find more differences, slightly more, 1.2 in 1,000. Now, if you compare any modern human to a Neanderthal, it's 1.5 differences. So clearly, we are more different from a Neanderthal than to any other present-day human, but still Neanderthals are quite close genetically. They are not very different. They are just sort of slightly more different than two humans are. The second big question, again, was this question of interbreeding, because previous evidence, before their data was available, sort of pointed to no admixture based on just mitochondrial results. I think the mainstream idea back in 2010 was that there was just a complete replacement of Neanderthals by modern humans. And there are many ways that you can analytically approach this question. I just want to show one of them because it's one of the simplest things that you can do. So you can simply determine then, using the Neanderthal genome, the affinity of two of two humans to a Neanderthal. So if you want to ask, for example, if Africa, so what you would predict is if there's been mixing between humans and Neanderthals, that should have happened in Eurasia. So you'd think that Eurasians or Europeans are closer to a Neanderthal than an African. And you can test this by identifying differences between, say, a European genome and an African genome, and then see which of the two states you find in the Neanderthal sequence. And sometimes the Neanderthal will match the European, sometimes will match the African, and then you either have this ABBA scenario as shown here, or BABA scenario as shown here, and then you can simply count the number of observations. And the null hypothesis is that's a zero. There's no difference between the two if you subtract the numbers, right? Because then would suggest that the Neanderthal is equally close to either one human. Now, doing this actually, first as a sort of sanity check that was done to comparing two Africans with respect to how similar they are to Neanderthal, and in fact you see that indeed you come out about zero. So they are both equally similar to Neanderthal, as you would expect, because Neanderthals are not known to be present in Africa. The surprise then came when comparing Africans and non-Africans, so comparing a Sun individual to a French, for example, you see that there's a strong affinity of the French to the Neanderthal, but surprisingly, that was not just limited to Europeans, but the same signal was picked up in Papua New Guinea, and in Chinese people, so all of the people outside of Africa showed this greater affinity to Neanderthals compared to Africans. And the idea that so you can translate this affinity using sort of more complex statistics in a percentage of Neanderthal ancestry, you can ask how much of the genome of the people in Eurasia is derived from Neanderthals, and you end up with numbers about 1.52%, which are sort of quite similar between European and Asians. It's actually slightly higher in Asia, as we know these days, than in Europe, but not much. And also you find this in Australia, for example, everywhere outside Africa. And this led us to speculate back in 2010 that this interbreeding between humans and Neanderthal must have happened very early on during the out-of-Africa events of modern humans. So possibly in the Levant, sort of the first humans leaving Africa, interbreeding with Neanderthals and then taking that Neanderthal contribution with them to the rest of the world. And you can also ask how old is that? When did that happen? Based on genetic data. And if you ask... And there you can make use of the fact that the nuclear DNA is not inherited in complete units of chromosomes from one generation to another, but that the chromosomes undergo recombination. So you have exchange of chromosome arms, and then if this is a hybrid, a human chromosome and a Neanderthal chromosome, it will in the next generation start to appear as a mixed chromosomes. There will be blocks of Neanderthals mixed with blocks of human sequences, and then these blocks become smaller and smaller and smaller over time, and this sort of the puzzle pieces, the pieces of the puzzle become smaller. And by dating the size of these pieces, you can actually determine that the Neanderthal-human interbreeding must have occurred something like 40 to 90,000 years ago, compatible with this idea that it happened early on when humans left Africa. Now, there's actually more evidence for Neanderthal interbreeding than just the idea that it happened perhaps in the Levant, which is based on a sort of lucky discovery. A few years ago, we started a study in Leipzig trying to reconstruct sort of the genetic history of modern humans over the past 40, 50,000 years. So from the earliest humans in Eurasia to people living today. And one of the things that we looked at in these genomes that we generated is the percentage of their Neanderthal ancestry. And one of the samples that we worked on was really peculiar in this respect. And this is a fossil that was found in Romania that we called Oase. And it's dated to about 40,000 years ago. And if you compare the level of Neanderthal ancestry in this individual, it really stands out above all other ancient or modern humans that we've sequenced. So there's an older individual, 45,000 year old from Siberia, Ust-Ishim, that shows about 4.5% Neanderthal ancestry. And then you see this decline in Neanderthal ancestry over time, which may be indicative of purifying selection, maybe showing that it's not always good to have Neanderthal ancestry in you, and that there's some selection against these components. But then there's this one big outlier here, the specimen from Oase. And you can do the same thing again. Now you not only determine the percentage of Neanderthal ancestry in this individual, but you start to look at how big are the blocks of Neanderthal ancestry. And if you do this in comparison to other humans first, these are a series of modern humans here, the lower four ones. And you can just go to one chromosome, chromosome 12 in this case, and you just sort of paint the parts of the chromosomes where these humans look like Neanderthals, and you will see these patches here, like small blocks of Neanderthal ancestry. You can go to a very old human genome, 45,000-year-old Ust-Ishim genome from Siberia, and you see that these blocks are slightly larger, sort of, which is exactly what I've been sort of mentioning before, consistent with that the Neanderthal, that this individual was closer in time to the interbreeding with Neanderthal. It still has longer blocks of Neanderthal ancestry. Now, if you put the Oase individual in, it really jumps at you that there are these large segments in the genome of this individual where almost half of the chromosome in this case sort of matches the Neanderthal. The few dark patches in here are simply missing data. So in reality, this is one big block of Neanderthal ancestry. And there are more of these, not only on chromosome 12, but you have several big ones, for example, on chromosome 5 and on other chromosomes, much bigger than has ever been seen in any other human individual. And you can use this, the percentage of Neanderthal ancestry in the individual, as well as the block sizes, to make an inference of how long ago this admixture must have taken place before that individual lived. And you will actually find that it was either 4, 5, or 6 generations ago, the admixture, that the Neanderthal interbred with a human. And this strongly suggests that, of course, this episode of admixture must have happened close to where this individual lived, assuming that it didn't travel from the Near East a few thousand kilometers. It gives clear evidence that there are multiple episodes of Neanderthal integration into humans. Now, one of the sort of biggest obstacles that we had with sequencing the genomes of Neanderthals was to find suitable fossils that had enough DNA preservation and that also they were not affected too much by modern human contamination, which is a big problem. And so for many years, we were collecting samples throughout the world and just screening them for DNA preservation. And this also included fossils that were not diagnostic, not morphologically informative. So fossils that could have come from a Neanderthal or a modern human. And these are particularly interesting for genetic research because it's sort of easier to sacrifice these fossils for genetic analysis than the most beautiful skulls, where you actually want to preserve the morphology and study the morphology. And one of these fossils that we sort of came by, or that was given to us by our by Russian collaborators, comes from a cave in Siberia, the Denisova cave. And it's a fragment of a distal phalanx, sort of the last part of the finger from a juvenile individual. And sort of the first thing that we did, as we always do if we acquire new samples from hominin fossils, is to look at the mitochondrial DNA. Because as I've shown you, at the mitochondrial level, it's very easy to separate Neanderthals from modern humans. And doing this, we actually found that this sequence of this finger bone did not fall within the variation of modern humans living today, and it did also not fall, to our surprise, into the variation of the Neanderthals that we know, but it did actually create a basal branch, a branch that is very different from all the humans and Neanderthals we've seen. And you can even put a sort of date on it, so you can compute when did the person live that was the mitochondrial ancestor of humans and Neanderthals, and that's about 500,000 years ago. But the person that was the last sort of ancestor of all these three lineages, including the Denisova sample, was a million years ago. So it's a highly divergent mitochondrial lineage. There was another big surprise with this specimen, which is that when we started to create sequences from the nuclear genome, they had much higher quality than of any other sample we've seen before. So one of the biggest struggles that we have is that bacteria who decompose the Neanderthal individuals leave their DNA, and since DNA binds so well to hydroxyapatite, we recover lots of bacterial DNA, and this is usually the vast majority. So for most of the specimens we are working with, it's only about 1% of the DNA comes from the actual specimen, and the rest is microbial contamination. In the best Neanderthal we've identified in many years, it was 5%. And that was sort of a big success. In this individual, it was 70%, is almost pure. And so it was very easy then to generate another genome sequence from it. And then the next surprise was that, sort of in contrary to the mitochondrial genome, the nuclear genome, which tells a sort of the more complete story of relatedness, showed that this individual was actually more closely related to Neanderthals than to modern humans, right? If you remember the mitochondrial tree, it was sitting somewhere like here, being sort of equidistant from Neanderthals in humans, but no, in fact, it is a distant relative of Neanderthals. And then asking the question again of admixture, is there any evidence of interbreeding of this the population this individual belonged to any modern human group, and there's actually no evidence that there's any contribution of the Denisovan population to Europe. There's almost no evidence, or evidence that emerged relatively late, that there's a contribution to people in East Asia, but very, very little. But there's this huge contribution of DNA to people living in Oceania, on the Philippines, and Australia, more than the Neanderthal contribution to people outside of Africa, like about three times more. So sort of this taken together, the fact that that we do find this different pattern of interbreeding, that the genome sequence of this individual looks different from a Neanderthal, and also based on the fact that we found there were two teeth found in the same cave, of which we generated a little bit data, not much, but which showed that they all belong to the same sort of population that finger bone belonged to. And these two teeth were very large in size, so quite different from the teeth of Neanderthal in humans, providing also some morphological evidence for a difference between these groups. We suggested that this Denisovan fossil should be considered part of a separate human group. So which is a bit of a scandal sort of in paleoanthropology, that it was the first time that geneticists came and based only basically on DNA sequences, said this is a different group of humans without presenting any fossil evidence for it. But I think it has been sort of quite well received in the community since then. Now, so the synthesis of these two things, of the sort of Neanderthal and the Denisovan genome sequencing effort, our current idea is as follows. We have modern humans leaving Africa, maybe about 50,000 years ago, perhaps even earlier, then interbreeding with Neanderthals in the Middle East, then taking this Neanderthal component with them when they colonize Eurasia. There's been additional admixture events for sure, as we've seen from the Oase specimen. And then, perhaps before modern humans then left mainland Asia to settle the Southeast Asian islands and Australia, they may have met Denisovans and incorporated the Denisovan component in their genome that they took along with them then. So, but this whole Denisovan home range is sort of pure speculation, right? We only find Denisovan DNA in Denisova cave, And then we find the modern human contribution to modern humans here. So we kind of believe that the Denisovan range was larger, was sort of extending all the way into Southeast Asia. Yeah. So that after these archaic humans went extinct, Neanderthals and Denisovans, we still have, they still left some traces in us, which are about 2% in people outside of Africa, of Neanderthal ancestry, and then on top of this, in people in this part of the world, 6% Denisovan ancestry, so you come up to almost 10% archaic ancestry in these individuals. Now, one of the sort of problems with, also this was certainly interesting insights, but I personally was always frustrated technically that the data quality was very poor of what we were producing. So, and to show this visually, is if you have one-fold coverage, so meaning that you see each position in the genome average only once, then there's no way of distinguishing between real evolutionary differences here in green and sequencing errors. And sequencing errors are quite frequent. So there are more sequencing errors than real differences. So in the end, what we end up with is data that is mostly dominated by error. And it would be great, of course, to have a quality of the genome that's comparable to what we can get from modern humans. And the problem being you cannot just sequence more DNA from some of these fossils. For example, the Denisovan type specimen, this little finger bone is extremely small. And we sampled 30 milligrams of it. It's really very little. And you just cannot take more. There's only this one bone. So one thing that I have sort of put much effort in over the last years is trying to improve the workflows that we have to generate DNA sequences. And one of the most important steps was this year, the library preparation step, the step where we attach adapters to our ancient DNA fragments. And without going into detail here, this is it's actually a beautiful problem. It's a seemingly simple problem to attach pieces of DNA to each other, but it does have some pitfalls. We came up with a sort of new solution of doing this, which instead of using the double helix, double-stranded DNA, we separate these two strands first, and then we convert each of them into a library and sequence them separately, which effectively, on paper, doubles your chance of recovering a DNA sequence. But in practice, we actually got 10 times more data out of with this approach. And sort of using just a little bit of DNA extract that we had left from this Denisovan finger bone, we could then generate a genome sequence that had 30-fold coverage. So each of these small lines here is a single sequence observation. You can see sort of this patchy pattern of coverage. Once we generated a very high-quality genome sequence, we do actually have many, many observations for each position in the genome, to an extent that you can even start to see differences between the two chromosomes that this individual inherited from father and mother. So we do have a quality here that is essentially the same as we would have if I would sequence my genome, my own genome. And we have then applied this technique not only to Denisovans but also to Neanderthals. We have now two high-quality Neanderthal genomes. One from also from Siberia, from Denisova cave, the same cave where we found the where we identified Denisovans, but we call it the Altai Neanderthal for distinction, even though it's the same cave. One from Croatia, we generated high coverage on the process of analyzing it, and also from an early modern human from southern Siberia. And there are some very interesting analyses you can do with high quality data. And one of them, as I mentioned, is we do now have both sets of chromosomes and not just one. So we can sort of, even though this we sequence just a single individual, it gives us a subsample of the genetic diversity in the population. And one simple way of expressing this genetic diversity is asking, if you compare the two chromosomes this individual inherited from father and mother, how far do you need to go to find the difference? If you do this in Africans, you need to walk something like 800-900 base pairs, and then you find a difference. Less in Europeans, if you have to walk further in Europeans, lower genetic diversity, they're less different. And if you go to a Denisovan individual, you have to walk three times as far as with any modern human. So you can also express this in a bar chart here as genetic diversity, and you will see that both in the Neanderthal, also in the Denisovan genomes, genetic diversity is much, much lower than even in people outside of Africa today. You can then ask, okay, if we perhaps you were unlucky and we sampled an individual that was created by incest, so maybe the parents were siblings, and that's why we see a low genetic diversity. And you can actually test this by checking for regions in the genome where the two chromosomes are identical. And this is what you would predict from incest. And if you do this in a modern human for comparison, you will see that sort of along the genome, you do find lots of variants. If you go to a Denisovan individual, you will see the same. There are some small blocks of what we call stretches of homozygosity, so stretches where the two chromosomes are identical. But if you go, for example, to the Altai Neanderthal individual, then you do find evidence for this, like long stretches of homozygosity, suggesting that the parents did actually have some degree of relatedness. And you can even compute this degree of relatedness, and you can see that they were either half-sibling, the parents, or grandfather and granddaughter, or uncle and niece, or something really complicated like double first cousins. So you can actually start to pick up the relatedness of the parents in your data. Still, this is not enough to explain the low genetic diversity in this individual. Sort of this genetic diversity remains very low even if you account for the fact that the parents were related. You can use very sophisticated approaches that have been developed in other groups. In this case at Harvard University and David Reich's lab, to reconstruct population size through time from a single individual. So you just by comparing the two chromosomes that this individual inherited from their parents, you can sort of go back in time and plot the size of the population. And what you will see if you do this for modern humans, you go back, this is present, and then you go to the past, you'll see at some point all these modern human, the trajectory of the population sizes becomes more and more similar, suggesting that there's been one common ancestor of modern humans here, and then modern humans diversified. If you do this, sort of here also suggesting that you see this bottleneck in populations outside of Africa coinciding with the out of Africa event, so you could pick this up in the data. If you now take both archaic individuals, the Neanderthal and the Denisovan, you will see that they have a very different population size compared to modern humans over time. They had a very small population for hundreds of thousands of years before they went extinct, finally. And you can also, then using high-quality data, determine admixture events in more precision. And so we found that not only Neanderthals contributed to modern humans, and Denisovans contributed to modern humans, as I've mentioned before, we also find evidence that Neanderthals contributed a little bit of DNA to Denisovans. We find evidence that an unknown archaic lineage contributed DNA to Denisovans. So just by looking at the Denisovan genome, you can see there's some component in there that looks unusual, that is something that is apparently older. And that may, for example, be Homo erectus, but this is pure speculation. We know that this lineage is probably more than a million years sort of apart from Denisovan, sort of suggesting that it's a very archaic human lineage. And we also find some evidence recently of introgression of human DNA into Neanderthals. So sort of the bottom line here is that all of these groups apparently interacted and exchanged DNA, but if you express this in percentages, it's always below 10%. It's always very low. So, so you can, based on DNA, all of these populations have groups of humans have a very distinct population history. Still, they are sort of still they are in exchange with each other. Then, as Jean-Jacques has also mentioned before, sort of there are interesting implications about the functions of the archaic contribution to modern humans. And there have been plenty of studies sort of looking at this. And it's also some work that we are actively pursuing in Leipzig, trying to understand what does it mean, the Neanderthal contribution. Does it give that, are there contributions that are beneficial for modern humans, helping humans to adapt in new environments? Or are there, more interestingly perhaps even, parts of the genome that are where it's negative for you to have Neanderthal DNA? So those would be interesting regions because they would indicate that something important sort of changed in the human genome in these regions that maybe define what makes humans sort of humans on a physiological level. But sort of I don't really have the time to go into this further. So the last part of my talk, I want to summarize an approach that we've taken to try to go a bit deeper back in time with ancient DNA. So all of what I've shown so far is DNA from the late Pleistocene. So we are looking only at sort of the tips of the evolutionary branches, the last surviving Neanderthals, sort of some of the last Denisovans, and relatively late modern humans. And we are far away from the ancestors of these groups. Now, if you want to go back in time, as I've shown you before, sort of the single biggest problem is fragmentation, DNA fragmentation. So if you have more and more DNA damage, your fragments are shorter and shorter and shorter. So obviously, one technical challenge you have to solve is that you have to be able to sequence very short DNA fragments. And then you can ask, how good are we in doing this? And this is sort of going to the world record holder in ancient DNA sequencing, a permafrost horse, a horse genome from the permafrost, 700,000 years old, sequenced by a group in Copenhagen. This is the size distribution of DNA sequences that you see, and it centers around 70 base pairs. So it's extremely short DNA, but as indicated here, we could make use of even shorter DNA fragments. About 35 base pairs would still be informative for us to identify as a horse or in what we're interested in as a Neanderthal sequence. So there's some more potential here. And so, so we went through this process again after having optimized library preparation, going to DNA extraction, as we noticed that there's actually a loss of short DNA fragments in this step. And what it comes down to, sort of making it short here, is that you have to add a little bit of schnapps to your DNA extraction process, and then you can recover really short DNA fragments. And this is just a comparison, the Pleistocene horse, the fragment size distribution. And this is if you take an ancient sample, use this sort of updated extraction method, you get extremely short DNA fragments, even shorter than you can make use of. Now, this is, of course, only one part of the problem. The other part of the problem is you also need to find a site that actually allows DNA preservation for such long periods of time. And we've been really lucky in identifying one such site, and there's really only one such site we've identified so far, which is in Spain, in northern Spain, in the mountains. it's in the Atapuerca complex of sites, so this is a spectacular assemblage of sites covering sort of a time span of more than a million years to almost present day. And one of the sort of subsites there, the Cima de los Huesos, pit of bones, has yielded 28 almost complete skeletons from the Middle Pleistocene, dated to roughly 400,000 years ago. Sort of it's the biggest assemblage of fossils from that time period in Eurasia. These fossils do show a mixture of sort of archaic morphology, as far as I understand, and some Neanderthal traits. So they may be very early Neanderthals. The good thing is that this site is located up in the mountains, but this particular cave is then 30 meters below ground. It's very difficult to access. You kind of have to crawl down and then use ladders and climb down. And there's very little air circulation between the cave and the outside. And the temperature in the cave is 11 degrees year-round. And you can sort of basically consider this as a perfect fridge. The samples are always at constant temperature and constant cool temperature. And indeed, when we attempted to extract DNA from fossils from the site, first using bears, because we usually make these attempts on non-human fossils to not sacrifice precious fossil material, And then later on humans, after we saw that the bears were successful, we did indeed recover very short ancient DNA sequences from the fossils. And we had to focus on mitochondrial DNA in this case, because as I mentioned before, there are many more mitochondrial sequences in a bone than nuclear sequences. So this is the first thing that we could look at. And this is showing you some real data, real ancient DNA data. These are each of these lines is one sequence, a sequence of one DNA fragment, sort of aligned or mapped to a human mitochondrial reference genome. And where you have a dot, it's a sequence is identical. Where you have a letter, the sequence differs from the reference. And so this is sequence data from a cima de los huesos, a long bone, a femur. And you see some sort of ugliness in here. For example, at this position, some sequences have a T consistent with the reference, other sequences have a C. So indicating there's a mixture of sequences here, and the mitochondrial genome should only be one type of sequence, so there's a problem. Well, what you can also see are many substitutions like these. So you have a C in the reference and then a T in your sequences, and that occurs over and over again here. And this is actually a very interesting pattern that we know is due to ancient DNA damage. That happens particularly at the ends and converts by deamination cytosines into uracils, so you read Cs as Ts when you sequence them. And you can actually make use of this pattern then and isolate only sequences that show evidence of deamination. And if you do that, you would actually see that they would all consistently support a C at this position, not a T. So you can purify your sequence data from present-day human contamination that you have on the bones, and then finally reconstruct a mitochondrial genome sequence. And really, after doing this sort of computer purification, there are really no sequences longer than 45 base pairs in there. Basically, all the information is between 30 and 40 base pairs that you have left. So it's extremely fragmented DNA. And it took us about 2 grams of material to get just a complete coverage of the mitochondrial genome, which is much, much more than we would need from a typical Neanderthal from the late Pleistocene period, where we need very, very small amounts of DNA, small amounts of material, about 10 times less often than what people use for radiocarbon dating. So it was really sort of a bit brute force and quite substantial material usage that was needed here. And what we then got is a tree relating the mitochondrial genome sequence of this individual to both Neanderthals and Denisovans. And the first thing I would like to point out is the length of this branch. So you can actually see that this individual from Spain sits on the shortest branch here, indicating that mutations are missing, indicating that it sort of died much longer ago than all these other individuals. And you can also sort of try to come up with a date of the fossil based on the sort of the number of missing mutations here, and then you end up sort of very similar to the geological date of the site about 400,000 years ago, even though the confidence intervals are very large. Now, the surprise here was that we do see this this affinity between the cima de los huesos specimens, which look like early Neanderthals, with Denisovans and not with Neanderthals. And sort of this highlights again, so this was very interesting, indicating that something sort of unexpected may be happening there, but it sort of again highlights this problem of mitochondrial DNA that you cannot really rely on it. Because it just tells you one aspect of relatedness. Perhaps the best comparison that you can make is, or analogy that you can make is, in our societies, I think this is true in France also, not just in Germany, the surname, it comes from the father, is inherited from the father, right? So if I had an African-sounding surname, right, I could still be here and sort of with the appearance that I have just because I had many, many other ancestors that were from Europe, for example, right? So it's like trying to judge the ancestry of a person just by the surname. Or it has also been described as if you would try to rip apart one page from a book and then try to make sense of the book just with a single page. Sometimes you're right and sometimes you're wrong. So the mitochondrial history really is only one aspect. And what you want to get is a nuclear genome. And we did indeed manage, after screening additional fossils and finding better preserved fossils with lower human contamination, to get a tiny, tiny little bit of the nuclear genome, like less than 1 per mil of the genome, extremely little. And now the problem being, again, that coverage is much, much less than one-fold. So you see each site in the genome only once, and you have many sequencing errors shown in red here. And so how can you sort of make use of these sequences? How can you learn something from them? And what you can do then is use a trick and first make use of the fact that we do have high-quality genome sequences from all human groups, from present-day humans, from Neanderthals, from Denisovans, and also from the chimpanzee as an outgroup. And you can identify sites where these genomes differ. For example, you can identify sites that are diagnostic for Neanderthals, so where the Neanderthal genome differs from humans, Denisovans, and the chimpanzee. And you can find Denisovan diagnostic sites. And then you only look at these sites. So instead of going along your sequences and identifying the differences to the reference genome, you go to a set of predefined sites, and then even at 1% error rate, you're 99% likely to be correct. And if you do this then you will see that there are about 100 informative sequences where a Cima de los Huesos fragment overlaps a Neanderthal informative site, and in 40 times it supports a Neanderthal state. There is about an equal number of observations of DNA fragments overlapping Denisovan diagnostic sites, but in only 10 cases we do see the Denisovan state. And this is a highly significant difference if you do the math. So this strongly indicates, or actually sort of shows, that the Cima de los Huesos individuals were actually closely related to Neanderthals and not to Denisovans. So they were, in fact, early Neanderthals or closely related to early Neanderthals. Sort of again, showing the problem with mitochondrial DNA, that it's sort of very difficult to rely just on a single marker of the genome. There's of course not so much you can do with this information, but there's one implication about the timeline of human evolution from this. So if you take for granted that the geological date and also the genetic date sort of agree on about 400,000 years for the Cima de los Huesos specimens, then you know that the Neanderthal-Denisovan split has already occurred by that time, because the Cima de los Huesos people are early Neanderthals or related to early Neanderthals. They are here somewhere. But that also means that the split not only between Neanderthals and Denisovans, but also between these archaics and modern humans must have happened much deeper in the past, perhaps even something like 650 to 800, maybe even 900,000 years ago. So it sort of tends to shift the split of archaic and modern humans to a time that is a bit older than some people may have previously thought. But obviously, sort of more work is needed and more data is needed to sort of make more interesting and additional inferences about these very ancient hominins from the Cima de los Huesos. And I hope that sort of this leaves enough to continue the story and perhaps another talk in a few years. And with this, I would like to thank you, and also, of course, indicate that this is not. Certainly not all my work. I contributed just a little bit to this. Svante Pebo, the head of the department in Leipzig, has sort of designed and directed these efforts for many years. It is very important for us. We rely on paleontologists to provide fossils, right? All this work is nothing without the paleontologists, so we are very grateful to the paleontologists, as well as the funding agency, which gives us excellent research budgets. Thank you for your attention.